What I'm talking about now is fairly important because we've heard a lot about science, but really not too much about what makes science work in the first place. You heard a bit in the last session a bit about that, actually, about how science grew up in the Christian worldview. So I'm going to talk a bit more about that. And just to remind you, we have a website, creation.com, and we have a sign-up sheet for our free email newsletter as well at the back. So look on our table, which is... It should be easy to find it in one of the corners there. So sign up for a free email newsletter. We promise not to spam you or give or sell your address to any third party. So that's one thing we recommend because it will keep you up to date with creation speakers in your area, as well as some new things coming up on our website and some of the articles in our archives of about 9,000 articles covering all sorts of topics to do with creation, the Bible, and Christianity. Now this talk, for instance, has a few articles on our site devoted to it. One is called The Christian Roots of Science, Biblical Roots of Modern Science. creation.com/roots is a shortcut we have for some of our articles, so it makes it easy to remember and find. And that picture there is Sir Isaac Newton, who is regarded as the greatest scientist of all time. Who discovered the law of gravity, three laws of motion, the spectrum of light, which is my own field of spectroscopy, this goes to Newton, the law of cooling, invented the reflecting telescope, jointly invented calculus, and yet he wrote more about the Bible than he wrote about science. He wrote huge amounts of work defending biblical chronology, which is actually means a young earth chronology, than he wrote about science. So this idea of some sort of conflict between science and Christianity is a complete fiction when you look at the history as well as the logic. Now another article is of mine is called Why Does Science Work at All? And creation.com/why science covers those sorts of issues as well, the assumptions needed for science to work. And in fact, the last chapter of my book, Greatest Hoax on Earth, covers some of the material in what I'm talking about as well. And if things run out here, you can order from our website, creation.com, and just tell them that I said you could have postage free. Because if we run out, we regard it as our fault, so we're not going to punish you for running out of things. So you go to our website, our web store, and just when you make an order, just ask for postage to be free because you were at this creation conference. Now, another book you might like is also on our table, Christianity for Skeptics. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we have in our materials is all about why creation is true and why we should believe the Bible at face value. But this book goes into things like why should we trust the Bible in the first place? How do we know that Jesus rose from the dead? And how do we answer Muslims and Hindus and atheists, New Agers? What's wrong with atheism? A whole chapter on that. How do you reconcile a loving God with death and suffering in the world? These are things which is one of the books we have, which is quite different from the other books of ours, and that's on our book table too. Now, just to remind you first about the difference between the operational science, which is what I'm going to talk about now, what is actually needed for operational science to work, the sort that put men on the moon and cures diseases, builds technology, in contrast to the evolution, which, as I say, was more a question of history than a question of science. So let's look at what operational science needs to work. Well, one of the assumptions we need is that the universe is real. Well, that seems obvious to us. And it comes from the fact that God created the heavens and the earth. So matter is real. It has an objective reality, regardless of what we might think about it. I don't really care if you believe in the law of gravity or not. You'll still fall off a cliff. So there's an objective reality independent of how we think. So this is very compatible with the biblical teaching that matter is real because God made it. So it seems rational to us, but there are some belief systems like the Eastern religions who almost deny the reality of the universe. They will claim that everything is an illusion. Now, one thing to think about that is if that is a self-refuting statement. A lot of attacks on Christianity are self-refuting because if everything is an illusion, that statement just made is also an illusion too. I'll go through some of the self-refuting statements often made by anti-Christians, like someone who says, there is no truth. Okay, how do you know? Is that true? Okay, another one. You can't know anything for certain. Well, how do you know that for certain? And one very common among atheistic scientists who really ought to know better if they actually thought a bit logically about it is that we should accept only scientifically testable claims. You've probably heard that from people like Richard Dawkins and co. The point is, that's a claim. Can that claim be tested scientifically? You can't put that claim in a laboratory and test it. So therefore, it's self-refuting because it's not a scientifically testable claim. Therefore, we should not accept that claim by its own reasoning. Another one which Christians, very common you hear now when we try and defend the pro-life position or pro-marriage, that Christians are wrong to judge that some behaviors are wrong, but isn't that a judgment itself? And one I've actually had from a cultist who denied the deity of Christ and the Trinity, and he claimed that I shouldn't be using the word Trinity, I should stick to words that are found in the Bible only. But the problem is, the word Bible is not found in the Bible. Now, another very important thing for science to work is that the universe is orderly. Now, again, the universe might superficially seem chaotic, but in fact, the Bible tells us that God is the author of confusion. He is a divine lawmaker. And there, from the biblical perspective, we should expect some underlying order in the universe. And this is essential for science to work. Science can't work unless water is always going to boil at 100 degrees, no matter if it's on Mars under the same conditions, same pressure and concentration, it'll boil at the same temperature. You see, but the thing is, why should that be? Again, it's this problem of induction that you heard last time. There's no reason from an atheistic point of view to expect the universe to be orderly, and you wouldn't expect it to be orderly if Zeus and his gang were in charge, because every god in the Greek pantheon has his own set of rules. And if the New Ages are right, the universe is one big thought, it could change its mind at any moment. And you heard about how a multiverse idea cannot give you the idea of natural laws either, because we could be in one of these strange universes where a certain law applies, but some of the other universes may not have that law. So again, multiverses can't get you real science either. They claim to be a scientific viewpoint, but it actually is a very anti-scientific viewpoint, as you learned. But only the Judeo-Christian worldview of a divine lawmaker gives you the whole idea of rules and laws that scientists can investigate. No other belief system can do that. And we also have that man may investigate the universe. You see, God gave man dominion over creation. That's right back in Genesis 1. You see, we don't have to pray to the river god before we boil water. Creation is not divine. In fact, if creation was divine, like some of the environmentalists seem to think, we could not do science. We cannot investigate the divine. Only if we're given dominion over creation do we have the right to investigate it, and in fact the obligation to. And that's why people like Newton and Kepler thought they were doing God's work with their scientific endeavors. I mean, Kepler was very famous for saying that he was thinking God's thoughts, God's thoughts after him. It's all a penny chicken, I think. And even before him, even after him, you've got people like Sir Michael Faraday, basically a little bit before Charles Darwin. He was the discoverer of the laws of electromagnetism, which means electrical generators. He discovered the electrical generator, which is what's powering our electrical stuff, ultimately. And he was a member of what people now call fundamentalist sect, because a sect which is very strict about the Bible. And deeply religious, viewed science, exploration of nature, as an extension of his heartfelt faith. And again, we see sometimes we debate a conflict of science and religion, but Faraday saw no such division. The book of nature we have to read is written by the finger of God. So unraveling the mysteries of nature was to discover the manifestations of God, because the science that he was doing was trying to discover exactly how God was upholding his creation, the laws by which he upholds creation. This is what Michael Faraday was trying to do. But this tradition goes back a long way, in fact, even into the Middle Ages, which were basically a Christian worldview in the Middle Ages. In other words, what C.S. Lewis would call mere Christianity, a general belief in the authority of the Bible, that there's a creator, that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. That sort of mere Christianity was the dominant belief system in the Middle Ages. And this was actually the period where modern science really started to flourish, where it was still born in places like Greece and China, which did not have this worldview of God as a divine lawmaker. So here's Rodney Stark, who wrote a book about this whole thing, it's called For the Glory of God, and he said it was not the wisdom of the East that gave rise to science. Science was not the work of Western secularists or even deists. It was entirely the work of devout believers in an active, conscious creator God. Now, if you listen to the propaganda in the education system, somehow Christianity is anti-science. But in fact, as was shown here, it was Christianity that brought science into existence in the first place. Now, another book written about this is by James Hannam, who had earned his PhD in the history of science from Cambridge University in the UK. And he wrote a book called God's Philosophers, which is all about the Middle Ages' contribution to science. And he says that recent research has shown that the Middle Ages were a period of enormous advances in science, technology, and culture. Now, the propaganda is that the Middle Ages were the Dark Ages, but that was actually a propaganda invented in the Renaissance. Because they talk about the Renaissance as being the rebirth, but the Renaissance was actually a reactionary step to go back, ignore the medieval advances, and go back to this romanticized view of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and popularizing their works, but ignoring the huge advances that had been made in the Middle Ages in all sorts of different areas. And Hannam's book talks about a lot of these. You see, the compass, paper, printing, stirrups, and gunpowder all appeared in Western Europe between 500 and 1500 AD. We see even more things. Printing. And the stirrup, you see, stirrup meant you could ride a horse properly, which is a very important thing. Instead of having to ride a chariot or very unstable riding a horse, you have a stirrup, which is really much more stable than anything that had gone on before them. And this is why Europeans could conquer the world. You see, China was once ahead of Europe in science, but Europe very much quickly overtook it. And you think of, people might decry the colonialism, but why was Europe in a position to be colonialist? It's because they made these huge advances in science, thanks to their Christian worldview. It doesn't mean they always used the science for good purposes, but the point is the science came about because of their Christian worldview. And more medieval Europe invented the spectacles. I mean, basically, a lot of you guys are wearing a Dark Ages invention. Spectacles were invented in the monasteries in the 13th century. So the monasteries of all places, but they discovered the laws of optics and spectacles in the 13th century. And things like mechanical clock, so timekeeping began there, real proper timekeeping, much better than hourglasses were before. And also developments in wind power and water power. It was basically an industrial revolution going on in the Middle Ages because wind and water power was a big advance on what had gone on before. And the blast furnace enabled steel to be made. And they also developed the heavy plow, which meant that the fields, agriculture, could become much more productive than it was previously. So there was actually a big population explosion in the Middle Ages compared to the Roman Empire times, because the ground could now support far more people, being so much more productive than it was. And here's more, lenses and cameras. All these things that we take for granted today actually owe their beginnings to these great scientists in the Middle Ages. And you also have people in the Middle Ages like Buridan and Orame in medieval France who even proposed that the Earth could be going around the sun. I mean, they still believed the Earth was the center, but they said there was nothing in science or scripture that could disprove the other way around, that the Earth was the one rotating. In fact, they even said it was more economical to have a small Earth rotate than the huge cosmos rotate. So they thought on economical grounds, it made more sense for the Earth to be rotating, and the Bible did not disprove that. So in fact, 200 years before Galileo, the medieval scientists had actually disproved most of the arguments used against him. And also go to Europe, you see these great cathedrals. These are architectural works of genius. Notre Dame in Paris, it took almost 200 years to build it. That's how amazing it was. I mean, Noah only took 70 years to build the ark, okay? But this is more like 200 years. And you see the outside and the inside were magnificent structures. And the thing is, this is a revolutionary advance because you see how the huge, wide open spaces in the cathedrals because they had these advances in architecture, like the flying buttresses that you could see on the right side of this picture, which could actually spread the load, which enabled much higher walls to be built because the stress was being taken by these flying buttresses. So again, huge advances in all sorts of different areas. Were done in the Middle Ages. So they weren't really dark ages at all. Now, but there was a big advance even on top of that when the Reformation happened. You see, the Reformation was the rediscovery of the authority and sufficiency of Scripture. But another thing the Reformation did was go back to the plain meaning of the Bible, because some of the medieval theologians got a bit carried away with allegorical interpretations, which really weren't grounded in the biblical text. And the Reformation rediscovered the objective nature of the biblical text. And we have a man, Peter Harrison, who even wrote a book called The Bible, Protestantism and the Rise of Modern Science. And he said, had it not been for the rise of a literal interpretation of the Bible by early modern scientists, modern science may not have arisen at all. See, once again, you will hear in the newspapers and the education system that a literal view of the Bible will harm science and take us back to the Dark Ages. That's the propaganda. But in fact, thanks to a literal interpretation, that science made a great leap forward even over the top of the Middle Ages advances, which was saying a lot. And he said, in sum, the Bible and its literal interpretation have played a vital role in the development of modern science. See, what an admission which is very different from what you normally hear. And in fact, you have other historians of science who say the same thing, like Stephen Snowbelin in Canada, who said that recent work has demonstrated a direct and positive relationship between the resurgence of a literal exegesis of the Bible in the Protestant Reformation and the rise of empirical method in modern science. And then he clarifies what he's talking about here, not wooden literalism, which means ignoring the figures of speech in the Bible. Like when Jesus said, "I am the door," you don't go and look for a knob on him, okay? That's wooden literalism, but in fact, literal really is the plain meaning. See, when the church fathers and the medieval people used the word literal, they meant what the text actually would mean to its original readers, which is what I would now call the grammatical historical approach to the Bible. So what do the text mean to the original readers? You see, to them, you see, when Jesus says, "I'm a door," the figurative meaning, in fact, is a literal meaning because that's what the text is teaching. It does not mean literalistic, which is ignoring any possibility of figure of speech. And that's what he's talking about here. Now, the point of that, going back to the objective meaning of the text, was transferred to objective understanding of nature. Because in the Renaissance, you have this problem. They go back to Aristotle, really promotes the works of Aristotle. He had his own ideas of how nature should behave. You see, he claimed that a heavy object will fall faster than a light object. But the medieval scientists and the Reformation scientists realized, well, God is free to create how he pleased. He is sovereign. He doesn't need to follow Aristotelian philosophy. And therefore, if the Bible is silent on something, the only way you can find out how God is upholding nature is to investigate, do experiments on it. So in fact, they dropped a heavy object and light object together. And apart from air resistance, we know they fall at the same rate. And on the moon, with the vacuum, a lead weight and a feather do fall exactly at the same rate. But here's a case. What they were doing here, according to Snowbelin, was that they applied this objective understanding of the Bible to objective understanding of nature. So they worked out what the Bible objectively means, and then they worked out what nature was objectively doing. So this is a big advance and led to the modern experimental science. So this is a great leap forward, and it was building on the shoulders of giants anyway, because the medievals had done so much, but the Reformation really took it to another level. Now, let's look at another perspective of what's needed for science. And one thing is that our thoughts are rational. You see, we actually can think rationally and logically. And that comes because God made us in his image. God thinks rationally. and logically, therefore, we should as well. Jesus Christ is called the Logos, the word from which we get logic. So logical thinking is essential for Christians. But if evolution is true, there's no reason to believe that our brains are logical, because we're just rearranged, it's just an evolved monkey brain, or ape brain, or whatever you want to call it. There's no reason to expect it to think logically. See, natural selection can select only for survival value, not for truth or for logic. So evolution cannot explain rational thought. And C.S. Lewis put this pretty well. He said, if the whole evolution of man was an accident, then all our present thoughts are mere accidents, the accidental byproducts of the movement of atoms. And this holds for the thoughts of the materialists as well as for anyone else's. But then if their thoughts of materialism are merely accidental byproducts, why should we believe them to be true? I see no reason to believe that one accident should be able to give me a correct account of all the other accidents. So even though the atheists might call themselves rationalists, they cannot justify rationality under their own worldview. And some of them call themselves free thinkers, but if they're right, the thoughts of their brain are just the result of movements of atoms obeying the fixed laws of chemistry. So in reality, they can't help what they believe because it's just the result of chemistry. So atheism cannot provide the basis for rational, logical thought. Now, one last thing I want to mention is that we need honesty in reporting of results, because I can't possibly do all the experiments I'm building on the shoulders of other people. I mean, I'm not going to go and measure the charge or weight or mass of an electron myself, because it's been done for me, and that I can use those results. But I have to assume from that the results have been reported honestly. Now, once again, the Bible tells us why we should be honest, because God forbids false witness, and Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He said, but truth shall set you free. So the Bible gives you a very good reason to want to tell the truth. But if evolution is true, why should we tell the truth? If we can propagate our genes better by telling a lie, then why not do that? And you see, even the atheists have realized that. Here is Jarol Nanya, who's an evolutionist. He said there are a lot of people uncomfortable with accepting evolution because it leads to what they see as a moral vacuum in which their best impulses have no basis in nature. And here is Richard Dawkins, the world champion evolutionist and Darwinist, saying that's just tough. We have to face up to the truth. So he's admitting here, if evolution were true, there's no objective basis for right and wrong, and therefore no reason to be honest. So evolution cannot give you a basis for honesty and truth-telling. And is it any wonder then we see things like this, where we have articles like Epidemic of Fraud in Science? I think you remember this fellow, don't you? That was published in our Journal of Creation. And this is based, very thoroughly documented, in secular journals like the magazine Discover, which said that fraud is now a serious, deeply rooted problem. And in fact, the prestigious journal Nature, probably the most prestigious in the world, talked about this fraud in these top universities like Cornell and Harvard and Yale. Now, Harvard and Yale were founded to be Christian universities. I mean, you look at the banners there. You've got Veritas, which looks at Veritas, which is light and truth. That's this biblical term. Jesus was meant to be the light and the truth. And therefore, this Harvard and Yale were founded to glorify Christ. And yeah, you've got the Ummim and the Thurim. That's what that symbol there, the Hebrew stuff. This is, again, a biblical reference. But now these places are founts of anti-Christian bigotry. Most of the universities in this country and in mine are very anti-Christian in their outlook. So they've actually departed from the intentions of their founder. So you might say that the fraud is just reaping their fruits of their rejection of Christianity, which provides the basis for truth. They reject the fruits, they reject the roots. Of course, the fruits are going to have a problem. But now, where did sin and lying come from? Well, according to the Bible, that started with Adam and the fall. And as Peter Harrison's written in another more recent book called The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science, where he discusses another great leap forward still after what I've just been talking about. Another great leap forward happened because of literal belief in a fall of Adam. This goes into Francis Bacon in the 17th century, where he said that his project to reform philosophy was motivated by an attempt to determine whether the human mind might be by any means be restored to its perfect and original condition, or if that may not be, yet reduced to a better condition than that which it now is. Because they believed that the fall of man didn't just affect our morality, but also affected our intellect. So they clearly believe that Adam, before the fall, had some amazing encyclopedic knowledge. And their whole project for science was to try to recapture some of that knowledge they believed Adam had. But you see how this presupposes that the Bible is accurate when it talks about a real man called Adam and a real fall from grace. So this is yet another very important milestone for the development of modern science. And yet again, of course, people don't want us to believe in a literal Adam, and yet Peter Harrison is saying that this is a very important milestone for science to advance, was this very belief in a literal Adam and a literal fall. Now, what can we do about this? I mean, science is an amazing potential, but I think it's also been marred. And see, science by itself is morally neutral. You see, science can tell you that pushing someone off a cliff is going to kill you, it kills that person, but it won't tell you whether it's right or wrong to do it. Okay, science can't do much, which is why you have science so grossly misused in the Nazi regime, just inventing more and more ways of killing millions of people. That was still science, but it was a very wicked abuse of science. So if you want to recover science for good and eliminate the problems, we need to recover the roots. And this is what the late Margaret Thatcher said. If we try to take the fruits of Christianity without its roots, the fruits will wither. And they will not come again until you nurture the roots. This is what we need to do. We need to nurture the roots again, which have been largely lost. And sadly, there are a number of of so-called Christian organizations like BioLogos, which want to try to disconnect Christianity from real history. They basically accept the history of the atheists, of uniformitarian long-age geology and goo-to-you evolution, but it totally disconnects the Bible from the real world. It's totally useless. Yet the Bible is a history book. It gives the true history of the world. And she also gives this warning here that we must not profess the Christian faith and go to church because we want social reforms or a better standard of behavior, but because we accept the sanctity of life, the responsibility that comes with freedom and the supreme sacrifice of Christ. So hopefully I've given you enough examples of how the Christian worldview was essential for science. First of all, in the Middle Ages, with a mere Christian worldview leading to enormous advances in all sorts of areas, but in the Reformation, with its rediscovery of objective understanding of Scripture being transferred to objective understanding of nature, and then the fall of Adam and the people like Francis Bacon trying to recapture some of the knowledge they believe Adam had before the fall. Now, it's probably not a bad idea to bust a few myths about science. No, I don't mind using those guys, even though they're a bit atheists, actually. But there's a lot of myths about science and evolution and Christianity. And one is that, in fact, it's a science versus religion battle. That Christianity and creation are religion and evolution is science. But let's look about that. The atheistic evolution is not an unbiased objective understanding of nature. Here is one man, Thomas Nagel, who's an atheist, and look what he says: I want atheism to be true. And he's upset that there are a lot of intelligent, well-informed believers. But he says, it's not that I just don't believe in God and actually hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Now, recently, this guy has actually gotten into trouble with his fellow atheists because he's now written a book which is very sympathetic to intelligent design. Because he sees the shortcomings in evolution and admits that the design movement has a strong case. But he's still an atheist and a very staunch one, as we can see from here. Now, here's another one. Lawrence Krauss has been in the news as well. He's written a book called Something from Nothing, basically. He wants to believe that we don't need a creator for our universe. And he is a very good mate with Richard Dawkins. They had a big love fest between each other at the University of Arizona. But he says, I would call myself an anti-theist. Not just an atheist, but an anti-theist. He's against God. I'd actually use the word misotheist, a God-hater. maybe I can't prove there's no God, but I wouldn't want to live in a universe with one. So he's got a bias. He's got an anti-God bias. He is not an objective scientist. I mean, I will admit my bias. I'm biased towards the Bible. Then the question is, why am I biased? Well, you may have a look at Christianity for skeptics and find out why I am biased. That is a good bias to have. But he's got a bias every much as strong as I have. And here's another case of bias here from Richard Lewontin, who's a geneticist and a Marxist from Harvard. And he said, we take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. Now, materialism in this context means that matter is all there is. And he said it's an absolute commitment because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So, I mean, never mind what the evidence says, he would not believe in an intelligent designer because he's already made up his mind that to accept materialism. He did not get his materialism from his science. He brought his materialism into his science. This is not objectivity. Now, another thing is, to show that it's not science versus religion, well, here's Michael Ruse, who's a philosopher, an atheist, and about 30 years ago, he testified in this big creation trial in Arkansas, where they wanted to teach a balanced treatment of creation and evolution in the schools, and there's a court case, the ACLU defended evolution only, and he was the ACLU's chief witness for philosophy, and he was very strong then that evolution was science and creation is religion. But after that, 20 years later, he said that evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution today, an explicit substitute for Christianity. So they'll tell you they got rid of religion from the public schools. No, they didn't. They got rid of Christianity from the public schools and replaced it with this religion of evolution. And in some cases, the religion of Islam seems to be making inroads there, but not the true religion of the God of the Bible. And here's Richard Dawkins. Again, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So you see, he needs evolution as a crutch for his atheistic faith. He can't do without it. That's why he fights so strongly against challenges to evolution, because it undermines the crutch he has for his own faith. He could not be an atheist without Darwin. And that is why the Darwinists and humanists and the atheists, they were celebrating Darwin's bicentennial 4 years ago. Now, is evolution required for science? Well, here again, here's another one. Mark Kirchner from Harvard, who said, over the last 100 years, almost all of biology has proceeded independent of evolution, except for evolutionary biology itself. Well, what a surprise that is, okay? See, molecular biology, biochemistry, and physiology have not taken evolution into account at all. So this idea that somehow evolution is essential for science to work, well, real scientists clearly don't agree that it really had nothing to do with real science. And in fact, in Australia, we had the same sort of thing, whereas a biology professor at one of the Australian universities, he was saying that evolution is so essential for biology, we can't possibly do biology without evolution, we've got to teach more of it. And then he laments in the same article, we can't get students to take evolution courses because it has no practical value. I mean, medicine. I mean, my father is a medical doctor, and he says evolution has nothing whatsoever to do with medicine. Because, I mean, a lot of the great advances in medicine were made before Darwin, and vaccination was discovered before Darwin by Edward Jenner. Okay, that's a very important advance. And you have things like Pasteur, the germ theory of disease. I mean, he was a contemporary of Darwin who rejected Darwinism. And from the germ theory of disease, we had Joseph Lister, another creationist, who discovered antiseptics to try and kill the germs that Pasteur had shown were responsible for diseases. And you have James Simpson discovering anesthesia. And he appealed to God putting Adam to sleep to make Eve from his rib. So he said, well, God used anesthesia, so can we. Okay. Another thing. See, even antibiotics don't need evolution. See, one of the people who discovered penicillin and won the Nobel Prize was Ernst Chain. And he was an Orthodox Jewish creationist who is extremely scathing of Darwinism. So you say even antibiotics was co-discovered by a creationist. So evolution has nothing to do with medicine either. So in fact, nothing to do with science. So the idea that evolution is science and creation is religion is one of the myths to be busted. Now, another very common myth is this Galileo idea of controversy between science and religion. And that turns a lot of Christian leaders into jello, and they use that as an excuse not to believe the Bible when it talks about six-day creation about 6,000 years ago and a globe-covering flood. Oh, Galileo, that's the only thing. Their mantra is the Galileo affair. But they've got totally the wrong message from the Galileo affair. When you understand the history, it in fact undermines their own case and not the Christian case. Now, here's an article on our website, creation.com/Galileo Quadricentennial. See, the quadricentennial of Galileo turning his telescope to the heavens is the same year as the Darwin bicentennial. And in fact, the magazine New Scientist was asking which one of those was the most antagonistic to Christian faith, Galileo or Darwin. But I'd say Galileo wasn't antagonistic at all, unlike Darwin. Now, first of all, it's important to realize that Galileo was actually a case of science versus science. Arthur Koestler said there existed a powerful body of men whose hostility to Galileo never abated, the Aristotelians at the universities. Yes, indeed, Galileo's discoveries were undermining the science establishment of his day, which has absorbed Aristotelian ideas, which includes the Ptolemaic model of the Earth being at the center of the universe. That was the science of their day. And Galileo is upsetting the scientists. And see, Koestler, who is not a Christian, has said innovation is a twofold threat to academic mediocrities. It endangers their oracular authority and evokes a deeper fear that their whole laboriously constructed intellectual edifice might collapse. Now, we see this with evolution today. It's a huge intellectual edifice. It undermines a lot of things, not just biology, but a lot of sociology and psychology are underpinned by evolution. The idea that somehow gay marriage is okay or an abortion is okay, all those are underpinned by an idea of evolution that things made themselves, and we're not accountable to a creator who's revealed his will to us in the Bible. Another expert on this is a Giorgio De Santillana, who said it's been known for a long time that a major part of the church's intellectuals were on Galileo's side, while the clero's opposition to him came from secular ideas. You mainly hear it was the church and the religion who opposed Galileo, but in fact Galileo's opposition was from the secular establishment, not from the church primarily. Now, see, here's one of the leaders, Cardinal Bellarmine. Now, the Catholic Church call him a doctor of the church. Now, there are only about 30-something doctors of the church in the Catholic theology. Now, a doctor is a higher title than a saint in that. So he's regarded as one of the leading intellectuals of the Catholic Church of all time. But he said, if there are real proof that the sun is the center of the universe, and the earth is in the third sphere, and the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the earth around the sun, then we should have to proceed with great circumspection and explain the passages of Scripture which seem to teach the contrary. I don't think there is any such proof because none has been shown to me. But he showed a willingness to accept Galileo's idea because he realized Galileo's idea, as the medieval scientists realized, was more economical to have a small spinning earth than a huge spinning universe. So everyone realized that Galileo's idea made mathematical sense. It was a much simpler thing because if you want to have the Earth at the center of the universe and you have things going around it, it's not a very simple path. You have to have epicycle, which is a circle rolling in another circle. The curve on that is called an epicycle. And Ptolemy's system, we needed more and more epicycles to make it work. With Galileo's system, in fact, all you need is the sun at the center and the planets going around it. In fact, Kepler was the one who solved it. Just a bit after Galileo, he realized that you can solve all the problems by having planets moved in elliptical orbits, and that was a very simple mathematical equation. And from that, Sir Isaac Newton, and to say another young Earth creationist, realized he could actually explain the elliptical orbits by having the three laws of motion and the law of gravity. So certainly, there's a very productive model for the development of modern science, while the Earth-centered model is not very productive. It seems ad hoc. And that was the main point about the Earth-centered universe. It's not very efficient. But the thing is, it had not been proved in Galileo's day. Galileo did not have the science on his side. We can look back 400 years and say, well, yes, of course the Earth is going around the sun. But in Galileo's idea, they didn't have that proof. So the thing is, we can't hold the church too much at fault when they didn't have the evidence. And Galileo was prone to exaggerating the evidence in his favor because he believed that the tides proved his theory. But that's actually wrong. So his main proof for the Earth's rotation was actually fallacious because the tides are caused by the moon. So the thing is, Galileo did not have the science on his side at that time. Now the problem is, though, the church at the time after this did what theistic evolutionists are doing today. They married their science of the day to the Bible. They tried to make the Bible conform to the science of its day. And this is what the theistic evolutionists are doing. They're trying to make the Bible fit in with evolution, which you just can't do. But this is exactly what the church did in Galileo's time. They made science the authority and tried to find passages in the Bible that fit that authority. Like here is one of them. The world cannot be moved. Okay, and they tried to recruit that to support the geocentric viewpoint of a stationary Earth. But in fact, this is not talking about that. And I can prove this very simply because the psalmist also says, I shall not be moved, using the same Hebrew verb. Now, does that mean the psalmist is in a straitjacket so he can't move? No, that's not what it's talking about. The word move means to falter and depart from the path that God has set in front of us. This is talking about God being in control of everything, that the earth and the psalmist will not falter from the path that God has set out for him. Nothing to do with cosmology here. And that applies to all the verses they were trying to recruit into supporting their earth-centered model. Now, another thing involved with the Galileo affair was papal politics, because Galileo was actually a very good friend of a cardinal who became Pope Urban. And in fact, the cardinal and Pope actually encouraged Galileo to publish his ideas. So they were very open to Galileo at that time. And you see, James Hannam says that, in fact, academic historians are convinced that this had much to do with the politics and the Pope's ego as it had to do with science. See, when Galileo had a very abrasive personality and put down his opponents a bit unfairly, now, in those days, they would publish their views in the form of a dialogue. So he published a view as a dialogue between a guy who believed in an Earth-centered universe and a sun-centered solar system. But the problem is Galileo chose a character called Simplicio, which means the fool, to represent the Earth-centered universe, and the Pope recognized his own arguments in the mouth of the fool. So he thought that Galileo was trying to make him look foolish. So, of course, these once best friends became bitter enemies. And this is why we have these trials of Galileo, because purely because of the Pope. Because most of the churches, the intellectuals, did not care about this. They realized that Galileo had said nothing heretical. It was just against what the Pope believed. It was a direct attack on the Pope. And I can prove this because just about 30 years after Galileo died, the Jesuits were teaching Galileo's ideas to the astronomers in China. So clearly it wasn't a science versus religion thing as far as most of the church was concerned. And they even used their cathedrals as giant sundials to analyze the heavenly motions. And they used that to help support Galileo's views. So once Galileo and the Pope had died out, there was no opposition to Galileo after that. And as I say, most of the people who developed the Galileo viewpoint were young Earth creationists like Kepler and Newton and Galileo himself. And Copernicus was a canon, basically a priest in the Catholic Church too. And the medieval theologians and medieval scientists were also priests like Oraim and Buridan, who likewise saw nothing wrong, nothing to contradict the Earth-moving position, which I call geokineticism, Earth-moving. They saw nothing in the Bible to conflict with that. Now, how do you solve this problem? Well, the answer is you think of things called reference frames. What have I got here? That's a speedometer. and it's set to zero. But hang on, isn't the Earth going about 1,000 miles per hour around its axis and much faster still around the Sun? So how could that speedometer be right? Well, the answer is the speedometer is calibrated in reference to the ground. And any physicist knows that all motion must be described in relation to something else. You have to have a fixed reference point to describe motion in relation to it. And you can select any reference frame you like. And just for most purposes on Earth, it's convenient to have the Earth as a reference frame. Your stop signs and speed limit signs are calibrated with Earth as a reference frame. I don't think you could tell a traffic cop, you get a ticket for running a red light or something, and you say, well, I can't possibly stop because the Earth is moving so fast around the Sun, stopping's impossible. Or things like, we use the word sunset today. Sunset is an Earth-centered term. It's far more convenient to say sunset at 7 o'clock than to say that at 7 o'clock the line of sight to the Sun intersects the horizon tangentially. That's harder to say, isn't it? So much more convenient to say sunset, and it's physically equally valid to do that. And see, Fred Hoyle understood this perfectly well because he said that we cannot say that the Copernican theory is right and the Ptolemaic theory wrong in any meaningful physical sense. All it is a choice of what reference frame you use. And that's what he says here in fairly complicated terms, that in fact they are exactly equivalent from a physical point of view, just a matter of choosing what reference frame you want. So Galileo could have solved the whole problem, because when he was asked, does the Earth move, he should have asked, in relation to what? Because the Earth does not move in relation to the Earth. So that's perfectly valid science. And one more thing I'll mention about Galileo is, in fact, the New Scientist article I referred to said that Galileo dethroned Earth from its privileged central position. But in reality, as far as they were concerned, the central position was the worst place to be, because they believed hell was right in the center of the Earth. That's horrible. And even the Earth itself was fallen. And the further away you got from the heaven, the closer you approach perfection. See, one of Galileo's discoveries that really upset this belief system of their day is the discovery of sunspots. Now, sunspots show there's imperfections on the Sun. But according to this scheme here, the Sun was supposed to be perfect. Now, the point about this is that when Galileo puts Earth to the third planet around the Sun, in fact, in that system, he was promoting it by moving it further away from the center. So once again, people have looked at Galileo anachronistically, reading our own worldview into the time 400 years ago, which you just can't do. So conclusion from this is a myth that Galileo controversy was science versus religion, but if you know the facts, you realize this is a complete and utter myth, and it was mainly science versus science. And then lesson from that is, don't marry your theology to today's science, because you'll be widowed tomorrow. Now, one more belief I'd like to tackle is this common idea that the church taught a flat earth in the Middle Ages. In fact, even your president has resorted to this fallacy. He said if some of these folks were around when Columbus set sail, they must have been founding members of the Flat Earth Society. They would have not have believed the world was round. So when you have the most powerful man in the world actually still believing this false anti-Christian history, there's a problem, I think. Because in reality, the church believed in a global earth. And this was documented about 20 years ago by a book called Inventing the Flat Earth by Jeffrey Burton Russell, a historian. And even the evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould praised this book very highly as being an incredibly accurate source of what the church really believed about the shape of the earth. Because he analyzed what the scholars of the church really taught. And in fact, the vast majority of the church scholars who discussed the topic believed the earth was round. Only a handful of guys, maybe one or two or three people below, believed that the earth was flat. One of them was called Cosmas Indicopleustes, which means voyager to India. Well, who's heard of him? Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? These are obscure figures. The atheists were saying that the Indicopleustes was typical of the church. In fact, he was very much an odd man out. Now, far better known in the church was the Venerable Bede in the 8th century. And he said, we call the earth a globe. That's not a flat earth there. And just in case you didn't get it the first time, he said the earth will represent the figure of a perfect globe and not circular like a shield, but round like a ball. So you get the idea? He believed the earth was ball-shaped, not flat. And this was centuries before Columbus. And this is a very important figure in the medieval church, the Venerable Bede. Now, the best theologian of the Middle Ages was probably Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. And he said the physicist proves the earth to be round by one means and the astronomer by another. So the leading textbook in the Middle Ages, the Summa Theologiae, taught the earth was round. Because they knew about eclipses. You see, in a lunar eclipse, you can see the shadow of the earth passing over the moon, and the shadow is always round, which is only possible if the earth is ball-shaped. They knew perfectly well that the earth was round. Sailors knew it better than anyone, because there's a myth about somehow people saw the masts disappearing below the horizon. More likely to be the other way around. Before telescopes, it was the sailors coming in who would see the mountains appearing first before the lowlands. That's what it was. So at least sailors in particular were in a good position to know the earth was round. Another thing that we know is also this symbol called the Globus Cruciger, which means the cross-bearing globe. And medieval rulers, the kings and emperors, used a globe to symbolize their power on earth. And the globe, of course, symbolized the earth. Now, isn't that interesting? A globe is symbolizing a flat earth. But you see, see how these guys are all holding a globe, and the huge cross over the globe is big because it's important, not because it's literally that big, but because the Christ is all important. So what this globe is doing is, you see in these several pictures here, they're all holding globes, is because they believe that Christ was a lord over the whole globe, but the king holding the globe, it was symbolizing that he held dominion over this portion of the globe under Christ. So right from the 8th century, you have a symbol called the Globus Cruciger, which showed that the kings and emperors believed the earth was round. So this was common knowledge in the secular rulers and in the church that the earth was round. Now, the issue of Columbus actually had nothing to do with the shape of the earth, because no one disputed it. The issue with Columbus, in fact, was the size of the earth. He got the wrong meaning of the word mile, because the Arabs had a different mile from the Italians, and therefore he actually underestimated how big the earth was. So if anyone laughed at Columbus, they were laughing at him because he didn't have enough provisions for his voyage. But remember, he wanted to reach India by sea the long way round. And in fact, his critics were right. He had actually got a smaller distance. And they were quite correct that he didn't have enough food to reach India the long way round. It was complete dumb luck. There was a continent in the way. But he thought he reached India. That's why the people today, the natives, are called Indians, because Columbus called them Indians. He thought he'd reach India, so these were the inhabitants of India. But again, it was only luck that he actually found the continent. But his critics were right. Columbus had underestimated the size of the earth. That was the issue, not the shape of the earth. But unfortunately, we have Washington Irving, one of your first American novelists. He was the one who invented this complete and utter fiction of Columbus being laughed at because he was the only one in the world who believed in a round earth. This is a complete and utter fiction. And then atheistic humanists like Andrew Dixon White and John Draper. I mean, Andrew Dixon White was the founder of Cornell University as a secular university, and they were trying to use this myth of the flat earth to bash opponents of Darwinism. That's what we had today, because Richard Dawkins is quite fond of accusing creationists of being flat earthers. He's continuing this false history to attack opponents of Darwinism. But in fact, it is an utterly, completely false history. Now, one last thing I'd like to leave you with about this is that, in fact, the leading evolutionist, the leading flat earther in the world today is an evolutionist. There is actually a flat earth society, and its members believe that the earth is a flat disc you can fall off of. But the leader of that society believes that's in evolution and in global warming. So if an evolutionist like Dawkins calls you a flat earther, you should point out that the leading flat earther is one of his fellow evolutionists, not a creationist. So again, this is a bit of an irony, the leading flat earther is an evolutionist, not one of us. So here's again another myth that's been busted, that the early church and medieval church believed in a flat earth. There's actually no historical basis for it. It's completely contrary to history. And yet this is a lie which has been taught to attack Christianity. In fact, one place you can find it is our Creation magazine. It's actually, it'll be a sign-up sheet on our book table for Creation magazine. This is the best thing we can have because it comes out quarterly. And the latest issue has my article about the flat earth, documenting the falseness of this charge against the church. And I say every issue has something, like for instance, here's one about dating methods, and this is not about boys meeting girls, it's about how old things are. And about how dating methods use, and what Spike was saying, that they all have assumptions behind them. Every issue of our magazine has an interview with a Bible-believing scientist, and every issue has a kids page, four kids page, which my little niece was enjoying here as a baby. Okay, so this is a very good thing for your whole family. Now we've actually got a digital version of the magazine, which means it can go on five different devices. So if you want to share it with your family, your kids, your grandkids, you can get the digital version so you can read it at the same time as they do. But thank you very much for listening to me, because I think this is actually a very important part to understand the history, because these are the arguments that atheists often throw at the church. And in fact, also those who want to compromise with long ages and evolution will throw these things at you as well. So it's important to have a historical fact so you know how to answer these false charges.